Well, welcome everyone to concurrent session 7B, the workers' compensation scheme updates for Victoria and Tasmania. We've all been to enough of these to know the general format, so there'll be presentations from the speakers from each of the states, Julie Evans from WorkSafe in Victoria and Brad Parker from Tasmania. There'll be time at the end, I expect, for any questions, but we'll have the speakers speak in turn and then take combined questions at the end. So the first of the two presentations is from Victoria WorkSafe, and that's going to be given to us by Julie Evans. Julie has worked as an actuary in the general insurance industry since 1992, following 15 years as a consultant, including a number of stints overseas. Julie joined WorkSafe in 2008. In her role as Director of Scheme Performance, she's involved in many different aspects of scheme management, both operational and financial. Julie's a Fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia and a serial presenter at conferences such as this. Please welcome Julie.
Thank you. And you'll all be pleased to know none of you have to bother with the feedback forms. I spent the last session, I entered feedback for this session. I did rather overestimate the numbers, though, so they'll be wondering why they got 40 responses for only about 25 attendees. The Victorian scheme, I'll just work out how I play. Try that one. No. Try that one. No. Ah. Wonder which one it was. It's on delay. The Victorian scheme is quite stable. Our legislation has been stable for some time. Our last major reforms were in 1999 with the restoration of common law. We had some benefit improvements in 2010, the so-called Hanks amendments, and then we rewrote the Act. So we now have the Work Act, but it was not to make changes to benefits. It was just to really to tidy up an act that had got amended a lot over the 30 years of the scheme, and so to sort of put it into an orderly fashion and try to improve some of the wording, but very careful where parts of the legislation had been subject to heavy judicial interpretation, not to change a thing. So I won't be up to, clearly it was the button I pressed first that it just took a long time to respond to. So there's no legislative change to update you on. So I'll just talk briefly about our strategic themes. And for those of you who were here a couple of years ago and came to Linda Young's presentation, you'd be familiar with these. We have five key strategic themes. Under our strategy 2017, we're now working on our next strategy as we're now in the second last year of 2017. We've made some good progress on a lot of these. Still some way to go on some, but as we move into our next strategy period, my guess is it'll start to look quite different. But we'll talk a little about that as we go. Actually, I should hold my glasses like that, shouldn't I? I gather that's the new way, our Prime Minister does it. Safety. So our approach, a lot of what I was going to talk about when I wrote this has been the subject of a fair bit of discussion already over the last day or so. So a lot of what you see here is very similar to the sorts of things that New South Wales were talking about, sort of that modern regulator approach, stepping back from the pure compliance approach to balancing enforcement and education and guidance. So that's the constructive compliance or modern regulator approach that we're using in safety. We still have a very strong visible presence with something of the order of 40 or 42,000 visits per year by our inspectorate, but they're also improving that balance of where they're there to ensure compliance and where they're there to guide and provide information. And we use a risk-based approach to sort of target areas, whether they're particular industries or particular subjects of issue at the moment, and a couple are listed there. In terms of our trends, so I've put on this chart both the claims per million hours worked on the left-hand axis, that's the blue line, the one at the top, and the four-week claims per million hours worked, which is the sort of orangey colour there, and it's on the right-hand axis. When we set up strategy 2017, we were looking for a 10 to 15% improvement in both of these indicators. So as we're coming into, as I said, we're now in our second last year. We have already reached a 10% improvement on the claims per mil, but a much more stubborn four-week claim measure there. Although I'm pleased to say that the stats I saw just before I came have suggested that that one is now improving this year as well. So we will continue to strive for improvements on this one. This one's the win-win. This is the one that is better for everyone. This helps all of our sustainability. It helps our community engagement. It helps the service. It's sort of the number one, and the thing that our people feel most passionate about. Return to work, the next of our strategic priorities. We did see our best result ever in 14-15. So we think we've moved, even if everybody else thinks this is as flat as a pancake. But certainly we're not going to rest on our laurels here. We know there's a lot more work to do. It's a bit like safety. This is the other win-win. If you have to be injured at work, well, let's at least get you back to work as soon as we possibly can. I've been at WorkSafe now for about 8 years, and as I came in, we were just developing this return to work index, the workers not yet at work 6 months after injury. Prior to that, we'd been relying on continuance rates, so just absence of weekly comp to sort of indicate return to work. This is a true return to work measure. What we've done over that time is ramp up the emphasis on this, both with our internal programs and with our agents, and the work of the Return to Work Inspectorate. Nikki this morning was talking about health benefits of work. We have a health benefits of safe work program in here with the new work capacity certificates, focusing on what it is that an injured worker can do rather than what it is they can't do. We've upped the agent incentive on this measure, and I was probably a bit sceptical, but I think we are seeing some innovation there, or at least some beginnings of innovation in the agent world on return to work. And it is certainly a government priority, including looking not just at what's happening in that first 6 months of injury, but what happens beyond that. Sustainability. We've always been pretty proud of ourselves on this one. Consider ourselves the poster child of injury schemes in Australia, I think. So we are a very large scheme. We've got about $14 billion in assets, $12 billion in liabilities, collect about $2 billion in premium, spend about $500 million in expenses. Our break-even premium rate is at 1.228%. We charge on average 1.272%, so we've got a buffer in there that's worth about $70 million a year. But it's not without its challenges. We've seen an increase in surgical spend in the tail, if you like. So people are on our scheme for a very long time. We have 30 years of experience now of the scheme, and we are still paying people from that very first year, the 1985-86 year. We're still seeing surgeries out in the tail. Particular issue at the moment with spinal surgeries and implantable pain therapies. But I suppose our biggest challenge really is the common law one. This is for 14-15, we had a profit from insurance operations of about $200 million, but it's the first time in 14 years that we haven't had an actuarial release. We had an actuarial increase last year of $60 million. Now, not huge in the scheme of a $14 billion asset organisation, but when you run on a series of years of releases of several hundred million dollars, it is sort of a bit of a wake-up call for us, I suppose you'd call it. And that came on the back of a $200 million increase in our common law liabilities. A chart. I've seen this so many times, I'm a bit blasé about it, but when I put it together here and I took off a few of the lines, it did look sort of rather stark. So this is common law lodgements by injury year by development quarter. So on the far left is the time of injury, and then we track the number of lodgements of common law as each injury year develops. And I've just put half a dozen selected years there. We've had about 15 years of this current common law system. So the one at the bottom, the bluish one, was from 2001-02, so a couple of years after common law access was restored in Victoria. And the top one there is 13-14, but 14-15 looks very similar, although very heavily projection-based at this point, very little in already. So the dark lines are those lodged to date, and the dotted lines show where our actuaries project the ultimates will get to. So when common law was restored, I think we were expecting something around the 1,800, 1,900 lodgements a year. And those first few years of the scheme did sit at probably not too far above that level. But we're now looking at half as much again, at around about 2,800 from the more recent injury years. So that's, I think that probably speaks for itself in terms of a pressure point for the scheme. What we are seeing is a growing proportion of these are for pain and suffering only, as opposed to both heads. So the average is coming down a bit. But a lot of this growth is at the low end, soft tissue. So for those of you who were at the plenary yesterday and heard is it Richard Burt talk about the TAC's common law access, ours is very much the same. So a 30% whole person impairment is you're deemed to be serious injury, but otherwise there's a narrative and there's four or five steps for that. Something like 90% of our cases come through that narrative. I think when it was costed, it was expected to be the other way around. But what we've seen is what you would expect with a narrative of that sort, which is a judicial interpretation, which just leads to erosion over time. But we manage what we've got. We manage what we've, the cards we're dealt, if you like, and we're continuing to look at how it is that we can influence this. And some of the things we were talking about earlier, return to work is a classic. If we can get better return to work results, we'll see that play out in common law. People who are back at work or who get the service that they want from their us as an organisation are less likely to go down the adversarial path. Or if they do, it's less likely to be an expensive settlement. It does cost us. I probably shouldn't go there, but for me this is a very expensive way of delivering benefits to individuals. So for each dollar we pay out in common law damages, we probably pay 45 maybe cents in legal costs. And for each dollar we pay to the claimant, who knows, but I think we're guessing at something like 30, 40, perhaps 50 cents in their dollar goes to their lawyer as well. So it's probably costing as much to deliver it as the person gets. So it's a fairly expensive delivery mechanism. Service. We've got a really complex measure for this one because it's got all the facets of who you're delivering the service to and the means by which you do it. We have had our best result on record. And again, this is all about balance and trying to ensure that you do the right thing by the right people most of the time. You try to do the best you can, I suppose, but you don't beat people up unnecessarily. You know, don't make them jump through hoops they don't need to jump through. One of the initiatives we introduced last year was a streamlined treatment where we looked at some of the analysis of common treatment requests that we were putting through the ringer and then pretty much always saying yes to, and looked to cut out that ringer part of it. And so we have seen the time taken to approve some treatments reduce considerably. But I think the practitioners don't see that as yet. They're not as aware of it as perhaps as we are. We see the volume. They see very few people in our system. Most of the general practitioners would only see one or two work cover patients, if any. So they see the bad experience, I suppose, and we see the volume. So, again, another area that we've improved our focus on in recent years just to try to get that balance. The culture in place is something that was previously sitting within our sustainability strategic objective, and it's only we pulled that out this year. And that's about our people. So we were talking yesterday about scheme culture, and it was sort of more about how it works for the participants. This is very much about our internal culture and the way that we work with our people, how they view us, and what it is that gets them engaged. The recurring theme, it doesn't matter what we look at and how bad or good the results of our employee opinion surveys are, the one about being passionate about the cause, if you like, the vision of our organisation, just rings through every time. And it's this Victorian workers returning home safe every day, and people just latch onto that and hold it sort of there as as the thing that gets them to work every day. And they might bag us about our leadership or about other aspects of morale, but this one's the one that we can hang on to. And what we're looking at as a leadership group now is really trying to tap into this. Recognise that this is the great strength, this is the thing that binds our people together. How is it that we can tap into that and work with them so that everyone feels better about being at work every day? And it's fair to say we've got a challenge coming up. We're moving to Geelong in 2018 with the first tranche, about 25% of our head office heading down at the end of next year. So for those of you not familiar with Victoria, Geelong's about 80 k's west, southwest of Melbourne. A lot of our people live out on the east of Melbourne, so it's a fairly substantial either commute or move for people. TAC did it some years ago. I think it was about 2009, was it, Andrew? I think thereabout. And lost a third.
There was about 40% and over 5 years, about 60%. But that is quite well.
So what we will see is a reduction in people. We'll see people leave our organisation. That's inevitable. And forced change is never easy. And what people were talking about this morning about resilience, what we're trying to do is build the resilience of our people, because whilst forced change isn't easy, change always brings opportunity. And if people can stop looking at the "but I don't want to" and look at, so what do I want? What can I do with it? What will I do now? Will I go? Will I move to Geelong? Will I commute? Will I look for flexible work arrangements? Will I try something different? But try to work with our people to see this now as an opportunity. We're going, that's it, that's done. That's a government policy decision. We don't have a say in that. So how is it that we can now make the best of it? And inevitably, we will be a different organisation when we're in Geelong than the one we are now. So how is it that we can make that the best organisation that we can be? So there's a lot going on with the Geelong relocation, as you can imagine. We're also continuing to evolve our agency model. So we have five claims agents and a sixth specialist. TAC manages our CIP, our catastrophic injuries. What we've been inclined to do over the last few contracts is be fairly heavy-handed with the agents and say, no, thou shalt do this. This is what we want you to do. If we all do it at the same time, it'll look good and we'll get somewhere. What we're trying to do now is just back off that a little and allow people the room to innovate. We know that we need to get a step change in return to work. We're not going to do that as a big fat WorkSafe. Our agents, all doing their own thing, are much more likely to find the next big gain, I think, in return to work and in service. But we're currently tendering for our agent contract, so I can't talk more about that one, as you can imagine. But new contract will emerge, or will start at the end of this current financial year. Stakeholder engagement framework, again, that's something that the guys from New South Wales were talking about. This is how we deal with our stakeholders. And I think we just want to be more accessible. We want to be trusted. I think the fact is a lot of people don't trust us. We want to be trusted. We have to earn that. We have to earn that trust. But by being more accessible, being more flexible, being balanced, listening, not just talking, we will get there in time. IT is a big challenge for us. We still have the action system with the blinking cursor in your tab through screens. We've got the system we've had since the early days. From an actuarial perspective, it's fantastic. Everything sits on one system. We've got every transaction, every claim. All sits together. There's no legacy system involved. But for a community that wants to do everything on a little device and swipe and get access to everything automatically, we've got big challenges ahead on this one. And part of the development of our next long-term strategy is looking at that, as well as, I think, probably the thing that is on the strategy front, the thing that's sort of been most of a shift in mindset for me is that we're not trying to work out what the world will look like in the next 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years, but looking at what it is that we need to look like to fit whatever it is that the world looks like. So focusing on the characteristics of our organisation, us being flexible, us being agile, us being accessible, rather than trying to think, well, business is going to look like this, we'd best structure ourselves accordingly. But that is me. Done. Ta-da! Thank you very much. Over to you. I'll do this one for you, shall I?
Oh, thank you. Thanks very much, Julie. Our next speaker, Brad Parker.
Why'd you do that?
My word. has more than 18 years' experience in workers' compensation and managing the operation of the Tasmanian Workers' Compensation Scheme. He's also responsible for managing the Asbestos Compensation Scheme for Tasmania. Prior to moving into workers' comp, Brad spent 12 years working in the area of injury prevention, performing various roles, including leading teams responsible for the occupational health and safety across a range of industry sectors. Interestingly, Brad has also held a range of engineering positions within the mining sector, and he holds tertiary qualifications in engineering, health and safety, and public sector management. He's also a non-executive director of the PIEF and a graduate of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. Please welcome Brad.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, everyone. So, button first.
Right.
Oh, look at that. So, I'm going to talk to you today about the Tasmanian Workers' Compensation Scheme, significantly smaller than the Victorian scheme, so the numbers might be a little bit on the smaller side compared to what Julie was talking about. Before I begin, I would acknowledge the work that Finity have done for us in our scheme review, and if anybody wishes to explore anything I touch on today in detail, good read on the website. So moving on. So what I propose to do today is just touch on the high points with regards to the Tasmanian Workers' Compensation Scheme, and then roll through into some of our initiatives both in the prevention space as well as the compensation side of the business. For those of you who had one or two too many last night, I've also provided some simplicity measures. So if the scheme's travelling well, you get the happy face, and if the scheme's not travelling well, you get the sad face. So you can ignore all the numbers and all the charts and all the rest of it, just follow the faces and you'll be right. So moving on. So just talking about the Tasmanian scheme in regards to the context. So it's a privately underwritten scheme. We have a piece of legislation called the Workers' Rehabilitation Compensation Act of 1988. We have around 16,000 policies. $150 million in premium gets collected each year. Seven licensed insurers, 10 self-insurers, including the state service. We have an average premium rate of about 1.92, and it seems to be stabilising now after 5 years of increases, primarily due to insurers having losses over that period of time. So just looking at the claim numbers for the 14-15 year, we're obviously in a situation where we're seeing a decline in claims, which is really quite good news. We've been running off the back of about 10,000 claims for a period of time. We're now down to 7,600, which is significantly lower than a lot of the other jurisdictions, but still it's still causing us a level of concern. The reason for the reduction, not exactly sure. It may be the downturn in the economy to a certain degree. I think we've also rolled out the National Harmonised Work Health and Safety legislation, and I think that's starting to have a bit of an impact in regards to the focus on health and safety and the prevention aspects. All in all, we're relatively happy that things are moving along in the right direction. We our actuaries, we get them to do a projection each on some of our key measures, and they're suggesting that we'll probably see an increase next year, but hopefully that won't be the case. Above excess claims are also lower, so it's not just we currently run an excess of the first week of wages and $200 in medical costs. There is a bit of a push to move away from that over time, and I'll talk a little bit more about that with some of the initiatives we've got happening. So out of that one, we get a happy face. Okay. So the next slide goes to our payments. So payments are 8% lower. We've seen a reduction of about $17 million, which is really quite quite good. What we're also seeking we've seen a reduction in our lump sum payments. The reason for that is that we made some amendments, changes to the scheme in 2009, which put a barrier in place in order to get access to lump sums for 2 years. So the claimant couldn't be given a lump sum within that two-year period without going to the tribunal and getting it endorsed. So what that did was put an artificial barrier in the scheme and provided a queue for those people who were prevented from going down that path. In 2012-13, we saw that gate get lifted. We saw an increase in our payments in that space due to that barrier, but now we're starting to see some level of normality kicking back into the scheme, which is encouraging as well. And those numbers are reducing from the point of view of we're seeing less lump sum payments coming through the scheme overall, which is also quite encouraging with regards to the ongoing role of the scheme. Self-insured payments were a little bit higher during the year, and for that they get a sad face. But overall, the state services also claims are higher than projected, so they also get the sad face. So all in all, if you looked at payments in total, we'll have a relatively happy face for that one. So moving on to the next slide, we're talking about weekly benefits. So again, weekly benefits are down by $48 million, I should say. We're seeing a reduction in the insured and self-insured area. I'll just get ahead of myself here. All right, just give me a chance to catch up. So we saw 1% reduction in the weekly benefits payment. Licensed insurers are doing particularly well with a 9% reduction and a minor increase in the self-insurer area. But the state service is an area where we are struggling big time. The cost of state service payments are significantly higher. Our return to work rates are nowhere near as good as in the insured area. We're seeing a more predominant role of mental stress and psychological injuries coming through, so there's a fair degree of work to be done in that space. There are some errors in that slide, which I noticed last night when I was going through this reduction, so, just bear with me on that one. Don't pay too much attention to it. But we do get an unhappy face for the state service. But we also are seeing that the lump sum payments are down by $10 million. But that being said, we had one payment last year of $10 million. So it doesn't take much in a very small scheme to get a big payment, and it knocks the hell out of your processes moving forward. But again, we seem to be down into an area where we're seeing a level of stability. I think the key thing here is that all the trends are suggesting that we're on a positive trajectory moving forward, and that's something that we'd again continue with a happy face for moving forward. One of the areas where we are seeing some significant reductions is in the medical payments. don't exactly know why medical payments are down, because we have a system where a doctor cannot certify for any longer than 14 days. So there's a mechanism in place where there you'd expect to be an ongoing attendance within the process, but overall the reduction is quite significant. So, we've spent a fair bit of time working with our doctors and trying to get them to embrace the concepts of the health benefits of work, certifying where and defining capacity, making sure that they understand the scheme objectives. It may be that that's starting to filter through, but yeah, I'm not exactly sure the behaviour that sits behind that. Obviously, with our lump sums reducing, we're also seeing the legal payments down, so we're getting the lawyers out of or having less of an influence in the process, which is also good. But, you know, previously there was a 17% increase, so over time it has been increased, but that's directly related to the activity in the lump sum. They would have had a period of time where there wasn't a lot of activity with the two-year break. And then once that was released, then they were able to capture that. But again, overall, happy face. So we're all travelling pretty well at the moment. So looking at some of the initiatives that we've got underway in regards to trying to the ongoing improvement of the scheme, one of the challenges we've had of recent times is we haven't been able to link our data around the dispute mechanisms component of the scheme with our claims data. So we've now started to bring that information together, which allows us to get a better understanding of what's happening in that space. We're seeing referrals increase significantly in the dispute area, moving over the last 4 years from 620 to 810, rolling through to the tribunal. And that's across all sectors. There's no one particular area. State services has a lower dispute rate than the licensed and the self-insured area, and the average time to resolve those issues has slipped out to about 3.5 months now, so it's hardly a speedy process. But at least we're able to measure and track that against our claims now, so that's seen as being a significant improvement. The other thing I didn't mention is that we're now seeing that the insurers are actually making a profit out of and have been for the last 2 or 3 years, you know, breaking even and starting to make a profit. That's off the back of about 5 years of making losses. So a scheme that continues making losses becomes less competitive as insurers start to say whether or not they want to play in this space. And we've done quite a bit of work in regards to working with the other privately underwritten jurisdictions, WA and ACT and Northern Territory. There's a lot more cooperation in regards to getting commonality because our insurers are pretty much the same in all those jurisdictions. We've recently updated our data system and that's now licensed to the ACT, so they're using the same system. We're using a single data spec across all jurisdictions in regards to the process. So we're trying to make it a little bit more user-friendly for the insurers and get some efficiencies into the process. So back on track with our current initiatives. The medical advisory and mentoring service, we've been working on this for a long period of time trying to get together, but again it's our focus on trying to get the doctors to behave in a manner that we think is appropriate with the scheme objectives. One of the challenges in that space is that where does a doctor go if he doesn't know what to do with a claim that he can't progress? You know, GPs typically have a recipe they run through, and when the claim gets to the point where they're not able to get it to move, it kind of stops or stalls, or they flick them off to some other doctor to deal with. What we're seeking to do is to try and provide them with a support mechanism so they have the ability to pick up the phone, log a call with the mentoring service, typically an occupational physician or someone that's got a lot of experience in workers' comp land, and then the call's paced back to that doctor and they discuss the case and work through that process. Only been rolled out in the last couple of months. The take-up hasn't been great, but again, it's early days yet and it's an 18-month trial to see whether or not it's worthy of pursuing. It also is underpinned by the second last dot point, which is the release of the Primary Treating Medical Practitioners Handbook, we've spent a fair bit of time going through trying to give some or describe what things the doctors should be doing and try and remove the things they shouldn't be doing. So, and giving them a reference. So if all else fails, I can pick out the book and say, oh, yeah, this is what's happening. So it gives them an understanding of the process. It gives them an understanding of the way we want them to behave. It gives them some guidance with regards to where to go and get more information. So, and that's, yeah, doctors like to be able to pick up and if they get stuck sort of thing. So that's been out for a few months now, available on the website if you want to have a look at it. So that's travelling along. Okay. Legislative amendments. We've all gone through that red tape reduction phase. Well, we're still living that hell at the moment. So we've gone out to the players within the scheme and said, tell us where all your red tape issues are. They've come back and we've got a bit of a list, and then we went back to the market and said, well, okay, out of this list, these are the options. We can blow up licensing insurers, we can blow up, remove self-insurance from the scheme, we can remove doctor accreditation or rehab accreditation, and a whole range of other things. And we've now got feedback as to where the scheme participants think we are or what we should be doing in that space. Surprisingly enough, most people don't want to change the scheme significantly. They actually like the dynamics of the scheme. There's a few areas where we probably need to simplify our processes and that sort of stuff, which I suppose where we're aiming to get to. Will it make any difference? Probably not. Will it take a lot of time, effort and grief? Probably yes. But anyway, we have to go through the mechanism of trying to improve it where we can. So as part of that process, we will be seeking to amend the legislation around March, April, maybe May or June, probably July. And as part of that, we'll also seek to change the governance arrangements around the operation, the scheme. We have a stakeholder-based board or representative board. We're going to move to a more contemporary skills-based board. We need to fix some things around age discrimination within our scheme, and yeah, there's a few other things like that that will all get picked up as part of that process. Claim forms and medical certificates. We run a paper-based claim form because we don't know how to change, and so we're starting to look at opportunities to move and try and break some of the shift the paradigms around. We must have a signature on a piece of paper and those sorts of things. So we've got a bit of work to do in that space. AMPO, which is the Accredited Medical Practitioners Online, is pretty much our accreditation system, but underpinning that accreditation system with training. So we hope to have that up and running early next year. I've spoken about the Primary Treating Medical Practitioners Handbook. And mental injuries, given the trends and a lot of the discussions we've heard today, we are not immune from it. We have a state service that has been infected, and we need to start to see whether or not our current compensation model is adequate. If it's not adequate, then where is it, you know, where is the bit that it's broken, or do we need to build a new system? So there's a lot of work to be done in that space. My gut feel is that I think the system works well. I think we just need to better educate the people who operate within it so that we're in a much stronger position to assist people who do suffer that type of injury. So all in all, we have a happy face with regards to lots of things to do in improving the scheme. And the final slide talks about the prevention side of it. So we not only do we run the compensation side of the scheme, but we also have the health and safety side of the business. One of the latest initiatives is Better Work Tasmania, which we launched in April this year. Better Work Tasmania is a bit of a unique beast in that it's a product of about 4 or 5 years work in consultation with industry. And what it seeks to do is provide a networking tool so people from large businesses have expertise in dealing with particular issues can hook up with small businesses that need assistance. If there's a training course being run at a particular organisation and they've got some vacancies, then people can actually log in and become and say, yeah, I'd like to go and do that high-risk work licence training course, and then they can fill in those spots. So it's a means of trying to get smaller business or people who know about how to solve a problem or manage a hazard to catch up with the people who don't. So it's trying to piggyback on that networking and talking about issues so that across the state we're getting some sort of continuity in regards to progression of reduction of these risks. As part of that, we have a mentoring program where people can log in and actually get assigned a larger organisation to mentor them to help develop their systems. And there's also an online induction program when small business aren't particularly good in online induction process as well. They can log in and they can do a basic one that talks about what's a hazard, how to manage a hazard, that sort of stuff. So it provides a mechanism to move into that space. The next issue is WorkSafe Tasmania Month, which is the month pretty much across the whole of the country. We're quite active in that space. And this quarter or this year, we just ran through the online stuff, so doing the whole webinar-y type stuff, and that seemed to be quite effective in getting out to people. We run the awards. If anyone we're of the view that an annual awards program has limited benefit, costs us an absolute fortune. And if anyone can give me some advice on how we can get rid of it when you've got a minister that loves it and thinks it's the best event of the year, then I would welcome those opportunities, because every time we try to reduce it, it just keeps bouncing back. We run a quarterly magazine, again, promoting health and safety and that sort of stuff. And then the final issue is WorkSafe Tasmania campaign. So we ran homecomings. We piggybacked off the Victorian stuff. We've had the most important things at work about 4 years ago. There's a feeling that we probably need to be starting to put something out into the market, so we'll be doing some work in that space. So all in all, that gets a happy face as well, which puts us to questions and a happy face. So thank you.
Well, thanks to both our speakers for two very comprehensive presentations. A special thank you, I think, is probably due to Brad for those slight transitions the morning after the night before. There's probably limited time for questions, but if anybody does have a question, please indicate, and if you could speak into the microphone.
The first one's to Julie, which will be very, very short response. Notice the Ombudsman has an own motion inquiry into the practices of some of the agents. Are you able to comment? The answer's probably no.
Very quick answer. Not appropriate to comment on an ongoing inquiry. Okay. We are cooperating with the Ombudsman.
And the other thing is to Brad. One of the things about WorkCover Tasmania is it punches hugely above its weight. It's probably done more innovative work with doctors than any other scheme that I'm aware of. I'm just wondering, Brad, is the capacity of the WorkCover Tasmania still there in terms of funding to provide the amount of work that you're doing?
I think the short answer is yes, Alan. I think the challenge we have at the moment is that we've gone from being a standalone business unit operating independent of government to all of a sudden being gobbled up by a government department and being subject to the political influences that occur within a scheme and the administrative inertia that applies within government departments. I think the intention is still there, but I think getting the rubber on the road is going to take a little bit longer, and it's going to be a little bit harder. We've had a lot of transition with regards to people moving out of the organisation. We've gone through a fair bit of disruption. So I think the short answer is it's going to be a bit bumpy for a while, but I'm hoping that we'll pick up. And I think, to a certain degree, having spent a couple of days here, has reinvigorated my views as to where we need to be going, and I'll be seeking to capitalise on that when we get back and progress the important stuff, not get too hung up on all the rubbish.
Okay, well, if you could both join me in thanking both Julie and Brad.